Eddie Cobb.
Yes. Polly sounded sad and thoughtful. You know that Wilma Jurczyk called her up one night and told her that if Nettie didn't shut the dog up, she'd come over and cut its throat. Well, Alan said evenly, I know that Nettie told you so, but I also know that Wilma frightened Nettie very badly, and that Nettie has had problems. I'm not saying Wilma Jurczyk isn't capable of making a call like that, because she is, but it might have only been in Nettie's mind. That Nettie had had problems was understating by quite a little bit, but there was no need to say more. They both knew what they were talking about. After years of hell, married to a brute who abused her in every way a man can abuse a woman, Nettie Cobb had put a meat fork in her husband's throat as he slept. She had spent 5 years in Juniper Hill, a mental institution near Augusta. She had come to work for Polly as part of a work release program. As far as Alan was concerned, she could not possibly have fallen in with better company, and Nettie's steadily improving state of mind confirmed his opinion. 2 years ago, Nettie had moved into her own little place on Ford Street, 6 blocks from downtown. Nettie's got problems, all right, Polly said, but her reaction to Mr. Gaunt was nothing short of amazing. It really was awfully sweet. I do have to get in and see this guy for myself, Alan said. Tell me what you think. And check out those hazel eyes. I doubt if they'll cause the same reaction in me that they seem to have caused in you, Alan said dryly. She laughed again, but this time he thought it sounded slightly forced. Try to get some sleep, he said. I will. Thanks for calling, Alan. Welcome. He paused. I love you, pretty lady. Thank you, Alan. I love you, too. Good night.
Good night.
He racked the telephone, twisted the gooseneck of the desk lamp so it threw a spot of light on the wall, put his feet up on his desk, and brought his hands together in front of his chest, as if praying. He extended his index fingers. On the wall, a shadow rabbit poked up its ears. Alan slipped his thumbs between his extended fingers, and the shadow rabbit wiggled its nose. Alan made the rabbit hop across the makeshift spotlight. What lumbered back was an elephant wagging its trunk. Alan's hands moved with a dexterous, eerie ease. He barely noticed the animals he was creating. This was an old habit with him, his way of looking at the tip of his nose and saying om. He was thinking about Polly. Polly and her poor hands. What to do about Polly? If it had been just a matter of money, he would have had her checked into a room at the Mayo Clinic by tomorrow afternoon, signed, sealed, and delivered. He would have done it, even if it meant wrapping her in a straitjacket and shooting her full of sedative to get her out there. But it wasn't just a matter of money. Ultrasound as a treatment for degenerative arthritis was in its infancy. It might eventually turn out to be as effective as the Salk vaccine, or as bogus as the science of phrenology. Either way, it didn't make sense right now. The chances were 1,000 to 1 that it was a dry hole. It was not the loss of money he dreaded, but Polly's dashed hopes. A crow, as limber and lifelike as a crow in a Disney animated cartoon, flapped slowly across his framed Albany Police Academy graduation certificate. Its wings lengthened, and it became a prehistoric pterodactyl, triangular head cocked as it cruised toward the filing cabinets in the corner and out of the spotlight. The door opened. The doleful basset hound face of Norris Ridgwick poked through. I did it, Alan, he said, sounding like a man confessing to the murder of several small children. Good, Norris, Alan said. You're not going to get hit with the shit on this either. I promise. Norris looked at him for a moment longer with his moist eyes, then nodded doubtfully. He glanced at the wall. Do Buster, Alan. Alan grinned, shook his head, and reached for the lamp. Come on, Norris coaxed. I ticketed his damn car. I deserve it. Do Buster, Alan. Please, that wipes me out. Alan glanced over Norris's shoulder, saw no one, and curled one hand against the other. On the wall, a stout shadow man stalked across the spotlight, belly swinging. He paused once to hitch up his shadow pants in the back and then stalked on, head turning truculently from side to side. Norris's laughter was high and happy, the laughter of a child. For one moment, Alan was reminded forcibly of Todd, and then he shoved that away. There had been enough of that for one night, please God.
Jeez,
That slays me, Nora said, still laughing. You were born too late, Alan. You could have had a career on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Go on, Alan said. Get out of here. Still laughing, Norris pulled the door closed. Alan made Norris, skinny and a little self-important, walk across the wall, then snapped off the lamp and took a battered notebook from his back pocket. He thumbed through it until he found a blank page and wrote, Needful Things. Below that, he jotted, Leland Gaunt, Cleveland, Ohio. Was that right? No. He scratched out Cleveland and wrote Akron. Maybe I really am losing my mind, he thought. On a third line, he printed, Check it out. He put his notebook back in his pocket, thought about going home, and turned on the lamp again instead. Soon the shadow parade was marching across the wall once more. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Like Sandberg's fog, the depression crept back on small, feline feet. The voice began speaking about Annie and Todd again. After a while, Alan Pangborn began to listen to it. He did it against his will, but with growing absorption. Polly was lying on her bed, and when she finished talking with Alan, she turned over on her left side to hang up the telephone. It fell out of her hand and crashed to the floor instead. The princess phone's base slid slowly across the night table, obviously meaning to join its other half. She reached for it, and her hand struck the edge of the table instead. A monstrous bolt of pain broke through the thin web the painkiller had stretched over her nerves and raced all the way up to her shoulder. She had to bite down on her lips to stifle a cry. The telephone base fell off the edge of the table and crashed with a single cling of the bell inside. She could hear the steady idiot buzz of the open line drifting up. It sounded like a hive of insects being broadcast via shortwave. She thought of picking the telephone up with the claws which were now cradled on her chest, having to do it not by grasping, tonight her fingers would not bend at all, but by pressing, like a woman playing the accordion, and suddenly it was too much. Even something as simple as picking up a telephone which had fallen on the floor was too much, and she began to cry. The pain was fully awake again, awake and raving, turning her hands, especially the one she had bumped, into fever pits. She lay on her bed, looking up at the ceiling through her blurry eyes and wept. Oh, I would give anything to be free of this, she thought. I would give anything, anything, anything at all. By 10 o'clock on an autumn weeknight, Castle Rock's main street was as tightly locked up as a Chubb safe. The street lamps threw circles of white light on the sidewalk and the fronts of the business buildings in diminishing perspective, making downtown look like a deserted stage set. Soon, you might think, a lone figure dressed in tails and a top hat, Fred Astaire or maybe Gene Kelly, would appear and dance his way from one of those spots to the next, singing about how lonely a fellow could be when his best girl had given him the air and all the bars were closed. Then, from the other end of Main Street, another figure would appear, Ginger Rogers or maybe Sid Charisse, dressed in an evening gown. She would dance toward Fred, or Jean, singing about how lonely a gal could be when her best guy had stood her up. They would see each other, pause artistically, and then dance together in front of the bank or maybe you so-and-so. Instead, Hugh Priest hove into view. He did not look like either Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly. There was no girl at the far end of Main Street advancing toward a romantic chance meeting with him, and he most definitely did not dance. He did drink, however, and he had been drinking steadily in the Mellow Tiger since 4 that afternoon. At this point in the festivities, just walking was a trick, and never mind any fancy dance steps. He walked slowly, passing through one pool of light after another, his shadow running tall across the fronts of the barber shop, the Western Auto, the video rental shop. He was weaving slightly, his reddish eyes fixed stolidly in front of him, his large belly pushing out his sweaty blue T-shirt. On the front was a drawing of a huge mosquito above the words Maine State Bird in a long sloping curve. The Castle Rock Public Works pickup truck he had been driving was still sitting at the rear of the Tiger's dirt parking lot. Hugh Priest was the not-so-proud possessor of several OUI driving violations, and following the last one, which had resulted in a 6-month suspension of his privilege to drive, that bastard Keaton, his co-bastards Fullerton and Samuels, and their co-bitch Williams, Castle Rock's fourth selectman was actually a select woman, had made it clear that they had reached the end of their patience with him. The next OUI would probably result in the permanent loss of his license, and would certainly result in the loss of his job. This did not cause Hugh to stop drinking. No power on earth could do that. But it did cause him to form a firm resolution. No more drinking and driving. He was 51 years old, and that was a little late in life to be changing jobs, especially with a long drunk driving rap sheet following him around like a tin can tied to a dog's tail. That was why he was walking home tonight, and one fuck of a long walk it was, and there was a certain Public Works employee named Bobby Dugas who was going to have some tall explaining to do tomorrow, unless he wanted to go home with a few less teeth than he had come to work with. As Hugh passed Nan's luncheonette, a light drizzle began to mist down. This did not improve his temper. He had asked Bobby, who had to drive right past Hugh's place on his way home every night, if he was going to drop down to the Tiger that evening for a few brewskis. Bobby Dugas had said, "Why, sure, Hubert." Bobby always called him Hubert, which was not his fucking name, and you could bet that shit was going to change too, and soon. "Why, sure, Hubert, I'll probably be down there around 7, same as always." So Hugh, confident of a ride if he got a little too pixelated to drive, had pulled into the Tiger at just about 4:05. He'd knocked off a little early, almost 1.5 hours early, actually, but what the hell, Deke Bradford hadn't been around, and had waded right in. And come 7:00, guess what? No Bobby Dugas. Golly gosh, wow. Come 8 and 9 and 9:30, guess further what? More of the same, by God. At 9:40, Henry Beaufort, bartender and owner of the Mellow Tiger, had invited Hugh to put an egg in his shoe and beat it, to make like a tree and leave, to imitate an amoeba and split. In other words, to get the fuck out. Hugh had been outraged. It was true he had kicked the jukebox, but the goddamn George Jones record had been skipping again. "What was I supposed to do, just sit here and listen to it?" he demanded of Henry. "You ought to take that record off, that's all. Guy sounds like he's having a fucking epileptic fit." "You haven't had enough, I can see that," Henry said, "but you've had all you're going to get here. You'll have to get the rest of it out of your own refrigerator." "What if I say no?" Hugh demanded. "Then I call Sheriff Pangborn," Henry said evenly. The other patrons of the Tiger, there weren't many this late on a weeknight, were watching this exchange with interest. Men were careful to be polite around Hugh Priest, especially when he was in his cups, but he was never going to win Castle Rock's most popular fella contest. "I wouldn't like to," Henry continued, "but I will do it, Hugh. I'm sick and tired of you kicking my rockola." Hugh considered saying, "Then I guess I'll just have to kick you a few times instead, you frog son of a bitch." Then he thought of that fat bastard Keaton handing him a pink slip for kicking up Dickens in the local tavern. Of course, if he really got fired, the pink would come in the mail. It always did. Pigs like Keaton never dirtied their hands or risked a fat lip by doing it in person, but it helped to think of that. It turned the dials down a little. And he did have a couple of six-packs at home, one in the fridge and the other in the woodshed. "Okay," he said. "I don't need this action anyway. Give me my keys." For he had turned them over to Henry, as a precaution, when he sat down at the bar 6 hours and 18 beers ago. "Nope." Henry wiped his hands on a piece of towel and stared at Hugh unflinchingly.
"Nope? What the hell you mean, nope?"
"I mean you're too damn drunk to drive. I know it. When you wake up tomorrow morning and see how your head feels, you're going to know it too." "Listen," Hugh said patiently. "When I gave you the goddamn keys, I thought I had a ride home. Bobby Dugas said he was coming down for a few beers. It's not my fault the numb fuck never showed." Henry sighed. "I sympathize with that, but it's not my problem. I could get sued if you wiped somebody out. I doubt if that means much to you, but it does to me. I got to cover my ass, buddy. In this world, nobody else does it for you." Hugh felt resentment, self-pity, and an odd, inchoate wretchedness welled to the surface of his mind like some foul liquid seeping up from a long-buried canister of toxic waste. He looked from his keys, hanging behind the bar next to a plaque which read, "If you don't like our town, look for a timetable," and back to Henry. He was alarmed to find he was on the verge of tears. Henry glanced past him at the few other customers currently in attendance. "Hey, any of you yo-yos headed up Castle Hill?" Men looked down at their tables and said nothing. One or two cracked their knuckles. Charlie Fortin sauntered toward the men's room with elaborate slowness. No one answered. "See?" you said. "Come on, Henry. Give me my keys." Henry had shaken his head with slow finality. "If you want to come in here and do some drinking another time, you just want to take a hike." "Okay, I will," Hugh said. His voice was that of a pouty child on the verge of a temper tantrum. He crossed the floor with his head down and his hands balled into tight fists. He waited for someone to laugh. He almost hoped someone would. He would clean some house then and fuck the job. But the place was silent except for Reba McIntyre, who was whining something about Alabama. "You can pick up your keys tomorrow," Henry called after him. Hugh said nothing. With a mighty effort, he restrained himself from putting one scuffed yellow work boot right through Henry Beaufort's damned old rockola as he went by. Then, with his head down, he passed out into darkness. Now the mist had become a proper drizzle, and Henry guessed the drizzle would develop into a steady, drenching rain by the time he reached home. It was just his luck. He walked steadily onward, not weaving quite so much now. The air had had a sobering effect on him, eyes moving restlessly from side to side. His mind was troubled, and he wished someone would come along and give him some lip. Even a little lip would do tonight. He thought briefly of the kid who had stepped in front of his truck yesterday afternoon and wished sulkily that he had knocked the brat all the way across the street. It wouldn't have been his fault, no way. In his day, kids had looked where they were going. He passed the vacant lot where the Emporium Galorium had stood before it burned down. You so-and-so, Castle Rock Hardware, and then he was passing Needful Things. He glanced into the display window, looked back up Main Street, only a mile and a half to go now, and maybe he would beat the rain before it really started to pelt down after all. And then came to a sudden halt. His feet had carried him past the new store, and he had to go back. There was a single light on above the window display, casting its soft glow down over the three items arranged there. The light also spilled out onto his face, and it worked a wondrous transformation there. Suddenly Hugh looked like a tired little boy up long past his bedtime, a little boy who has just seen what he wants for Christmas, what he must have for Christmas, because all at once nothing else on God's green earth would do. The central object in the window was flanked by two fluted vases, Nettie Cobb's beloved carnival glass, although Hugh didn't know this and would not have cared if he did. It was a foxtail. Suddenly it was 1955 again. He had just gotten his license, and he was driving to the Western Maine Schoolboy Championship game, Castle Rock versus Oxford Hills, in his dad's 53 Ford convertible. It was an unseasonably warm November day, warm enough to pull that old rag top down and tack the tarp over it, if you were a bunch of hot-blooded kids ready, willing, and able to raise some hell, that was, and there were six of them in the car. Peter Doyon had brought a flask of log cabin whiskey. Perry Como was on the radio. Hugh Priest was sitting behind the white wheel, and fluttering from the radio antenna had been a long, luxuriant foxtail, just like the one he was now looking at in the window of this store. He remembered looking up at that fluttering foxtail and thinking that when he owned a convertible of his own, he was going to have one just like that. He remembered refusing the flask when it came around to him. He was driving, and you didn't drink while you were driving, because you were responsible for the lives of others. And he remembered one other thing as well, the certainty that he was living the best hour of the best day of his life. The memory surprised and hurt him in its clarity and total sensory recall. Smoky aroma of burning leaves, November sun twinkling on guardrail reflectors, and now, Looking at the foxtail in the display window of Needful Things, it struck him that it had been the best day of his life, one of the last days before the booze had caught him firmly in its rubbery, pliant grip, turning him into a weird variation of King Midas. Everything he had touched since then, it seemed, had turned to shit. He suddenly thought, I could change. This idea had its own arresting clarity. I could start over. Were such things possible? Yes, I think sometimes they are. I could buy that foxtail and tie it on the antenna of my Buick. They'd laugh, though. The guys would laugh. What guys? Henry Beaufort? That little pissant Bobby Dugas? So what? Fuck 'em. Buy that foxtail, tie it to the antenna, and drive. Drive where? Well, how about that Thursday night AA meeting over in South Paris, for a start? For a moment, the possibility stunned and excited him, the way a long-term prisoner might be stunned and excited by the sight of the key left in the lock of his jail cell by a careless warder. For a moment, he could actually see himself doing it, picking up a white chip, then a red chip, then a blue chip, getting sober day by day and month by month. No more Mellow Tiger, too bad, but also no more payday spent in terror that he would find a pink slip in his envelope along with his check, and that was not so too bad. In that moment, as he stood looking at the foxtail in the display window of Needful Things, Hugh could see a future. For the first time in years, he could see a future, and that beautiful orange fox brush with its white tip floated through it like a battle flag. Then reality crashed back in, and reality smelled like rain and damp, dirty clothes. It would be no foxtail for him, no AA meetings, no chips, no future. He was 51 fucking years old, and 51 was too old for dreams of the future. At 51, you had to keep running just to escape the avalanche of your own past. If it had been business hours, though, he would have taken a shot at it anyway. Damned if he wouldn't. He'd walk in there, just as big as Billy be damned, and ask how much was that foxtail in the window. But it was 10 o'clock, Main Street was locked up as tight as an ice queen's chastity belt, and when he woke up tomorrow morning, feeling as if someone had placed an ice pick between his eyes, he would have forgotten all about that lovely foxtail with its vibrant russet color. Still, he lingered a moment longer, trailing dirty, calloused fingers over the glass like a kid looking into a toy shop window. A little smile had touched the corners of his mouth. It was a gentle smile, and it looked out of place on Hugh Priest's face. Then, somewhere up on Castle View, a car backed off several times, sounds as sharp as shotgun blasts on the rainy air, and Hugh was startled back to himself. Fuck it. What the hell are you thinking of? He turned away from the window and pointed his face toward home again, if you wanted to call the two-room shack with the tacked-on woodshed where he lived home. As he passed under the canopy, he looked at the door and stopped again. The sign there, of course, read, Open. Like a man in a dream, Hugh put his hand out and tried the knob. It turned freely under his hand. Overhead, a small silver bell tinkled. The sound seemed to come from an impossible distance away. A man was standing in the middle of the shop. He was running a feather duster over the top of a display case and humming. He turned toward Hugh when the bell rang. He didn't seem a bit surprised to see someone standing in his doorway at 10 minutes past 10 on a Wednesday night. The only thing that struck Hugh about the man in that confused moment was his eyes. They were as black as an Indian's. "You forgot to turn your sign over, buddy," Hugh heard himself say. "No, indeed," the man replied politely. "I don't sleep well, I'm afraid, and some nights I take a fancy to open late. One never knows when a fellow such as yourself may stop by and take a fancy to something. Would you like to come in and look around?" Hugh Priest came in and closed the door behind him. "There's a foxtail," Hugh began, and then had to stop, clear his throat, and start again. The words had come out in a husky, unintelligible mutter. "There's a foxtail in the window." "Yes," the proprietor said. "Beauty, isn't it?" He held the duster in front of him now, and his Indian black eyes looked at Hugh with interest from above the bouquet of feathers which hid his lower face. Hugh couldn't see the guy's mouth, but he had an idea he was smiling. It usually made him uneasy when people, especially people he didn't know, smiled at him. It made him feel like he wanted to fight. Tonight, however, it didn't seem to bother him at all, maybe because he was still half-shot. "It is," Hugh agreed. "It is a beauty. My dad had a convertible with a fox tail just like that, tied to the antenna, back when I was a kid. There's a lot of people in this crummy little burg wouldn't believe I ever was a kid, but I was. Same as everyone else."
"Of course."
The man's eyes remained fixed on Hugh's, and the strangest thing was happening. They seemed to be growing. Hugh couldn't seem to pull his own eyes away from them. Too much direct eye contact was another thing which usually made him feel like he wanted to fight, but this also seemed perfectly okay tonight. "I used to think that foxtail was just about the coolest thing in the world." "Of course." "Cool. That was the word we used back then. None of this rad shit. And gnarly. I don't have the slightest fucking idea what that means, do you?"
But the proprietor of Needful Things was silent, simply standing there, watching Hugh Priest with his black Indian eyes over the foliage of his feather duster.
"Anyway, I want to buy it. Will you sell it to me?"
"Of course," Leland Gaunt said for the third time.
Hugh felt relief and a sudden, sprawling happiness. He was suddenly sure that everything was going to be all right. Everything. This was utterly crazy. He owed money to just about everyone in Castle Rock and the surrounding three towns. He had been on the ragged edge of losing his job for the last 6 months. His Buick was running on a wing and a prayer. But it was also undeniable.
"How much?" he asked. He suddenly wondered if he would be able to afford such a fine brush and felt a touch of panic. What if it was out of his reach? Worse, what if he scrounged up the money somehow tomorrow, or the day after that, only to find that the guy had sold it?
"Well, that depends."
"Depends? Depends on what?"
"On how much you're willing to pay."
Like a man in a dream, Hugh pulled his battered Lord Buxton out of his back pocket.
"Put that away, Hugh."
"Did I tell him my name? Did I?"
Hugh couldn't remember, but he put his wallet away.
"Turn out your pockets, right here, on top of this case."
Hugh turned out his pockets. He put his pocket knife, a roll of certs, his Zippo lighter, and about $1.50 in tobacco-sprinkled change on top of the case. The coins clicked on the glass. The man bent forward and looked at the pile.
"That looks about right," he remarked, and brushed the feather duster over the meager pile.
When he removed it again, the knife, the lighter, and the certs were still there. The coins were gone.
Hugh observed this with no surprise at all. He stood as silently as a toy with dead batteries while the tall man went to the display window and came back with the fox brush. He laid it on top of the cabinet beside Hugh's shrunken pile of pocket paraphernalia. Slowly, Hugh stretched out one hand and stroked the fur. It felt cold and rich. It crackled with silky static electricity. Stroking it was like stroking a clear autumn night.
"Nice?" the tall man asked.
"Nice," Hugh agreed distantly, and made to pick up the foxtail.
"Don't do that," the tall man said sharply, and Hugh's hand fell away at once. He looked at Gaunt with a hurt so deep it was grief.
"We're not done dickering yet."
"No," Hugh agreed. "I'm hypnotized," he thought. "Damned if the guy hasn't hypnotized me." But it didn't matter. It was, in fact, sort of nice. He reached for his wallet again, moving as slowly as a man underwater.
"Leave that alone, you ass," Mr. Gaunt said impatiently, and laid his feather duster aside.
Hugh's hand dropped to his side again.
"Why is it that so many people think all the answers are in their wallets?" the man asked querulously.
"I don't know," Hugh said. He had never considered the idea before. "It does seem a little silly."
"Worse," Gaunt snapped. His voice had taken on the nagging, slightly uneven cadences of a man who is either very tired or very angry.
He was tired. It had been a long, demanding day. Much had been accomplished, but the work was still just barely begun. It's much worse. It's criminally stupid. Do you know something, Hugh? The world is full of needy people who don't understand that everything is for sale, if you're willing to pay the price. They give lip service to the concept, that's all, and pride themselves on their healthy cynicism. Well, lip service is bourgeois, absolute bourgeois. Bourgeois, Hugh agreed mechanically. For the things people really need, Hugh, the wallet is no answer. The fattest wallet in this town isn't worth the sweat from a working man's armpit. Absolute bourgeois. And souls. If I had a nickel, Hugh, for every time I ever heard someone say, I'd sell my soul for thus and such, I could buy the empire, state, building. He leaned closer, and now his lips stretched back from his uneven teeth in a huge, unhealthy grin. Tell me this, Hugh, What in the name of all the beasts crawling under the earth would I want with your soul? Probably nothing. His voice seemed far away. His voice seemed to be coming from the bottom of a deep, dark cave. I don't think it's in very good shape these days. Mr. Gaunt suddenly relaxed and straightened up. Enough of these lies and half-truths. Hugh, do you know a woman named Nettie Cobb? Crazy Nettie? Everyone in town knows Crazy Nettie. She killed her husband. I know. Now listen to me, Hugh. Listen carefully. Then you can take your foxtail and go home. Hugh Priest listened carefully. Outside, it was raining harder, and the wind had begun to blow. Brian, Miss Ratcliffe said sharply. Why, Brian Rusk, I wouldn't have believed it of you. Come up here, right now. He was sitting in the back row of the basement room where the speech therapy classes were held, and he had done something wrong, terribly wrong, by the sound of Miss Ratcliffe's voice. But he didn't know what it was until he stood up. Then he saw he was naked. A horrible wave of shame swept over him, but he felt excited, too. When he looked down at his penis and saw it starting to stiffen, he felt both alarmed and thrilled. Come up here, I said. He advanced slowly to the front of the room while the others, Sally Myers, Donnie Frankel, Noni Martin, and poor old half-bright Slopey Dodd, goggled at him. Miss Ratcliffe stood in front of her desk, hands on hips, eyes blazing, a gorgeous cloud of dark auburn hair floating around her head. You're a bad boy, Brian. A very bad boy. He nodded his head dumbly, but his penis was raising its head, and so it seemed there was at least one part of him that did not mind being bad at all, that, in fact, relished being bad. She put a piece of chalk in his hand. He felt a small bolt of electricity when their hands touched. Now, Miss Ratcliffe said severely, you must write, I will finish paying for my Sandy Koufax card 500 times on the blackboard. Yes, Miss Ratcliffe. He began to write, standing on tiptoe to reach the top of the board, aware of warm air on his naked buttocks. He had finished, I will finish paying, when he felt Miss Ratcliffe's smooth, soft hand encircle his stiff penis and begin to tug on it gently. For a moment he thought he would faint dead away, it felt so good. Keep writing, she said grimly from behind him, and I'll keep on doing this. Miss Ratcliffe, what about my tongue exercises? Asked Slopey Dodd. Shut up, or I'll run you over in the parking lot, Slopey, Miss Ratcliffe said. I'll make you squeak, little buddy. She went on pulling Brian's pudding while she spoke. He was moaning now. It was wrong, he knew that, but it felt good. It felt most sincerely awesome. It felt like what he needed. Just the thing. Then he turned around, and it wasn't Miss Ratcliffe standing at his shoulder, but Wilma Jerzyk, with her large, round, pallid face and her deep brown eyes, like two raisins pounded deep into a wad of dough. He'll take it back if you don't pay, Wilma said. And that's not all, little buddy. He'll... Brian Rusk woke up with such a jerk that he almost fell out of bed and onto the floor. His body was covered with sweat. His heart was pounding like a jackhammer, and his penis was a small, hard branch inside his pajama trousers.
He sat up, shivering all over. His first impulse was to open his mouth and yell for his mother, as he had done when he was small and a nightmare had invaded his sleep. Then he realized that he wasn't small anymore. He was 11, and it wasn't exactly the sort of dream you told your mother about anyway, was it? He lay back, eyes wide and staring into the dark. He glanced at the digital clock on the table next to the bed and saw it was 4 minutes past midnight. He could hear the sound of rain, hard now, pelting against his bedroom window, driven by huge, whooping gasps of wind. It sounded almost like sleet. My card, my Sandy Koufax card, is gone. It wasn't. He knew it wasn't, but he also knew he would not be able to go back to sleep until he'd checked to make sure it was still there, in the loose-leaf binder where he kept his growing collection of Topps cards from 1956. He had checked it before leaving for school yesterday, had done so again when he got home, and last night, after supper, he had broken off playing pass in the backyard with Stanley Dawson to check on it once more. He had told Stanley he had to go to the bathroom. He had peeked at it one final time before crawling into bed and turning out the light. He recognized that it had become a kind of obsession with him, but recognition did not put a stop to it. He slipped out of bed, barely noticing the way the cool air brought out goosebumps on his hot body and made his penis wilt. He walked quietly across to his dresser. He left the shape of his own body behind him on the sheet which covered his mattress, printed in sweat. The big book lay on top of the dresser in a pool of white light thrown by the street lamp outside. He took it down, opened it, and paged rapidly through the sheets of clear plastic with the pockets you put the cards in. He passed Mel Parnell, Whitey Ford, and Warren Spahn, treasures over which he had once gloated mightily, with hardly a glance. He had a moment of terrible panic when he reached the sheets at the back of the book, the ones which were still empty, without seeing Sandy Koufax. Then he realized he had turned several pages at once in his hurry. He turned back and, yes, there he was, that narrow face, those faintly smiling, dedicated eyes, looking out from beneath the bill of the cap. To my good friend Brian, with best wishes, Sandy Koufax. His fingers traced over the sloping lines of the inscription. His lips moved. He felt at peace again, or almost at peace. The card wasn't really his yet. This was just sort of a trial run. There was something he had to do before it would really be his. Brian wasn't completely sure what it was, but he knew it had something to do with the dream from which he had just wakened, and he was confident that he would know when the time, tomorrow, later today, came. He closed the loose-leaf binder, Brian's collection, Do Not Touch, carefully printed on the file card, scotch-taped to the front, and returned it to the dresser. Then he went back to bed. Only one thing about having the Sandy Koufax card was troubling. He had wanted to show it to his father. Coming home from Needful Things, he had imagined just how it would be when he showed it to him. He, Brian, elaborately casual. Hey, Dad, I picked up a 56 today at the new store. Want to check it out? His dad would say okay, not really interested, just going along with Brian to his room to keep Brian happy. But how his eyes would light up when he saw what Brian had lucked into, and when he saw the inscription. Yes, he would be amazed and delighted, all right. He'd probably clap Brian on the back and give him a high five. But then what? Then the questions would start. That was what? And that was the problem. His father would want to know, first, where he had gotten the card, and second, where he had gotten the money to buy such a card, which was A, rare, B, in excellent condition, and C, autographed. The printed signature on the card read Sanford Koufax, which was the fabled fastball pitcher's real name. The autographed signature read Sandy Koufax, and in the weird and sometimes high-priced world of baseball trading card collectors, that meant fair market value might be as much as $150. In his mind, Brian tried out one possible answer.
I got it at the new store, Dad, Needful Things. The guy gave it to me at a really wicked discount. He said it'd make people more interested in coming to his store if they knew he kept his prices down. That was good as far as it went, but even a kid still a year too young to pay the full adult price of admission at the movies knew it didn't go far enough. When you said somebody had given you a really good deal on something, people were always interested. Too interested. Oh, yeah? How much did he knock off? 30%? 40? Did he give it to you for half price? That'd still be 60 or 70 bucks, Brian, and I know you don't have that kind of money just laying around in your piggy bank. Well, actually, it was a little less than that, Dad. Okay, tell me, how much did you pay? Well, 85 cents. He sold you a 1956 autographed Sandy Koufax baseball card in uncirculated condition for 85 cents? Yeah, that's where the real trouble would start, all right. What kind of trouble? He didn't know exactly, but there would be a stink, he was sure of that. Somehow he would get blamed, maybe by his dad, but by his mom for sure. They might even try to make him give it back. And there was no way he was going to give it back. It wasn't just signed. It was signed to Brian. No way. Hell, he hadn't even been able to show Stan Dawson when Stan came over to play pass, although he'd wanted to. Stan would have fudged his jockeys. But Stan was going to sleep over on Friday night, and it was all too easy for Brian to imagine him saying to Brian's dad, "So how'd you like Brian's Sandy Koufax card, Mr. Rusk? Pretty rad, huh?" The same went for his other friends. Brian had uncovered one of the great truths of small towns. Many secrets, in fact all the really important secrets, cannot be shared, because word has a way of getting around, and getting around fast. He found himself in a strange and uncomfortable position. He had come by a great thing and could not show or share it. This should have vitiated his pleasure in his new acquisition, and it did to some extent. But it also afforded him a furtive, niggardly satisfaction. He found himself not so much enjoying the card as gloating over it. And so he had uncovered another great truth. Gloating in private provides its own peculiar pleasure. It was as if one corner of his mostly open and good-hearted nature had been walled off and then lit with a special black light that both distorted and enhanced what was hidden there. And he was not going to give it up. No way. Negatory. Then you better finish paying for it, a voice deep in his mind whispered. He would, no problem there. He didn't think the thing he was supposed to do was exactly nice, but he was pretty sure it wasn't anything totally gross either. Just a prank, a voice whispered in his mind. And he saw the eyes of Mr. Gaunt, dark blue, like the sea on a clear day, and strangely soothing. That's all. Just a little prank. Yeah, just a prank, whatever it was. No problem. He settled deeper under his goose-down quilt, turned over on his side, closed his eyes, and immediately began to doze. Something occurred to him as he and his brother Sleep drew closer to each other. Something Mr. Gaunt had said. You will be a better advertisement than the local paper could ever think of being. Only, he couldn't show the wonderful card he had bought. If a little thought had made that obvious to him, an 11-year-old kid who wasn't even bright enough to keep out of Hugh Priest's way when he was crossing the street, shouldn't a smart guy like Mr. Gaunt have seen it too? Well, maybe, but maybe not. Grown-ups didn't think the same way as normal people, and besides, he had the card, didn't he? And it was in his book, right where it should be, wasn't it? The answer to both questions was yes, and so Brian let go of the whole thing and went back to sleep as the rain pelted against his window and the restless fall wind screamed in the angles beneath the eaves. The rain had stopped by daylight on Thursday, and by 10:30, when Polly looked out the front window of You So-and-So and saw Nettie Cobb, the clouds were beginning to break up. Nettie was carrying a rolled-up umbrella and went scuttling along Main Street with her purse clamped under her arm, as if she sensed the jaws of some new storm opening just behind her. "How are your hands this morning, Polly?" Rosalie Drake asked. Polly sighed inwardly. She would have to field the same question, but more insistently put, from Alan that afternoon, she supposed. She had promised to meet him for coffee at Nan's luncheonette around 3. You couldn't fool the people who had known you for a long time. They saw the pallor of your face and the dark crescents below your eyes. More important, they saw the haunted look in the eyes. "Much better today, thanks," she said. This was overstating the truth by more than a little. They were better, but much better? Uh-uh. "I thought, with the rain and all, it's unpredictable what makes them hurt. That's the pure devil of it. But never mind that, Rosalie. Come quick and look out the window. I think we're about to witness a minor miracle." Rosalie joined Polly at the window in time to see the small, scuttling figure with the umbrella clutched tightly in one hand, possibly for use as a bludgeon, judging from the way it was now being held, approach the awning of Needful Things. "Is that Nettie? Is it really?" Rosalie almost gasped. "It really is. My God, she's going in!" But for a moment, it seemed that Rosalie's prediction had queered the deal. Nettie approached the door, then pulled back. She shifted the umbrella from hand to hand and looked at the facade of Needful Things, as if it were a snake which might bite her. "Go on, Nettie," Polly said softly. "Go for it, sweetie." "The close sign must be in the window," Rosalie said. "No, he's got another one that says Tuesdays and Thursdays by appointment only. I saw it when I came in this morning." Nettie was approaching the door again. She reached for the knob, then drew back again. "God, this is killing me," Rosalie said. "She told me she might come back, and I know how much she likes carnival glass, but I never really thought she'd go through with it." "She asked me if it would be all right for her to leave the house on her break so she could come down to what she called that new place and pick up my cake box," Polly murmured. Rosalie nodded. "That's our Nettie. She used to ask me for permission to use the John." "I got an idea. Part of her was hoping I'd say no, that there was too much to do. But I think part of her wanted me to say yes, too." Polly's eyes never left the fierce, small-scale struggle going on less than 40 yards away, a mini-war between Nettie Cobb and Nettie Cobb. If she actually did go in, what a step forward that would be for her. Polly felt dull, hot pain in her hands, looked down, and saw she had been twisting them together. She forced them down to her sides. "It's not the cake box or the carnival glass," Rosalie said. "It's him." Polly glanced at her. Rosalie laughed and blushed a little. "Oh, I don't mean Nettie's got the hots for him or anything like that, although she did look a little starry-eyed when I caught up with her outside. He was nice to her, Polly. That's all. Honest and nice." "Lots of people are nice to her," Polly said. "Alan goes out of his way to be kind to her, and she still shies away from him." "Our Mr. Gaughan has got a special kind of nice," Rosalie said simply. And as if to prove this, they saw Nettie grasp the knob and turn it. She opened the door, and then only stood there on the sidewalk, clutching her umbrella, as if the shallow well of her resolve had been utterly exhausted. Polly felt a sudden certainty that Nettie would now pull the door closed again and hurry away. Her hands, arthritis or no arthritis, closed into loose fists. "Go on, Nettie. Go on in. Take a chance. Rejoin the world." Then Nettie smiled, obviously in response to someone neither Polly nor Rosalie could see. She lowered the umbrella from its position across her chest and went inside. The door closed behind her. Polly turned to Rosalie and was touched to see that there were tears in her eyes. The two women looked at each other for a moment and then embraced, laughing. "Way to go, Nettie," Rosalie said. 2 points for our side," Polly agreed, and the sun broke free of the clouds inside her head a good 2 hours before it would finally do so in the sky above Castle Rock. 15 minutes later, Nettie Cobb sat in one of the plush, high-backed chairs Gaunt had installed along one wall of his shop. Her umbrella and purse lay on the floor beside her, forgotten. Gaunt sat next to her, his hands holding hers, his sharp eyes locked on her vague ones. A carnival glass lampshade stood beside Polly Chalmers's cake container on one of the glass display cases. The lampshade was a moderately gorgeous thing and might have sold for $300 or better in a Boston antique shop. Nettie Cobb had, nevertheless, just purchased it for $10.40, all the money she had had in her purse when she entered the shop. Beautiful or not, it was, for the moment, as forgotten as her umbrella. "A deed," she was saying now. She sounded like a woman talking in her sleep. She moved her hands slightly so as to grip Mr. Gaunt's more tightly. He returned her grip, and a little smile of pleasure touched her face. "Yes, that's right. It's really just a small matter. You know Mr. Keaton, don't you?" "Oh, yes," Nettie said. "Ronald and his son Danforth. I know them both. Which do you mean?" "The younger," Mr. Gaunt said, stroking her palms with his long thumbs. The nails were slightly yellow and quite long. "The head selectman. They call him Buster, behind his back," Nettie said and giggled. It was a harsh sound, a little hysterical, but Leland Gaunt did not seem alarmed. On the contrary, the sound of Nettie's not-quite-right laughter seemed to please him. "They have ever since he was a little boy." "I want you to finish paying for your lampshade by playing a trick on Buster."
"Trick?"
Nettie looked vaguely alarmed. Gaunt smiled. "Just a harmless prank, and he'll never know it was you. He'll think it was someone else."
"Oh."
Nettie looked past Gaunt at the carnival glass lampshade, and for a moment something sharpened her gaze. Greed, perhaps, or just simple longing and pleasure.
"Well,
it will be all right, Nettie. No one will ever know. And you'll have the lampshade." Nettie spoke slowly and thoughtfully.
"My husband used to play tricks on me a lot. It might be fun to play one on someone else."
She looked back at him, but now the thing sharpening her gaze was alarm.
"If it doesn't hurt him." "I don't want to hurt him. I hurt my husband, you know."
"It won't hurt him," Gaunt said softly, stroking Nettie's hands. "It won't hurt him a bit. I just want you to put some things in his house."
"How could I get in Buster's?"
"Here." He put something into her hand, a key. She closed her hand over it.
"When?"
Nettie asked. Her dreaming eyes had returned to the lampshade again.
"Soon."
He released her hands and stood up. "And now, Nettie, I really ought to put that beautiful lampshade into a box for you. Mrs. Martin is coming to look at some Lalique in..." He glanced at his watch. "Goodness, in 15 minutes. But I can't begin to tell you how glad I am that you decided to come in. Very few people appreciate the beauty of carnival glass these days. Most people are just dealers with cash registers for hearts." Nettie also stood and looked at the lampshade with the soft eyes of a woman who is in love. The agonized nervousness with which she had approached the shop had entirely disappeared. "It is lovely, isn't it?"
"Very lovely," Mr. Gaunt agreed warmly. "And I can't tell you, can't even begin to express, how happy it makes me to know that it will have a good home, a place where someone will do more than dust it on Wednesday afternoons and then, after years of that, break it in a careless moment and sweep the pieces up and then drop them into the trash without a second thought."
"I'd never do that," Nettie cried. "I know you wouldn't," Mr. Gaunt said. "It's one of your charms, Netitia." Nettie looked at him, amazed.
"How did you know my name?"
"I have a flair for them. I never forget a name or a face." He went through the curtain at the back of his shop. When he returned, he held a flat sheet of white cardboard in one hand and a large fluff of tissue paper in the other. He set the tissue paper down beside the cake container. It began at once to expand with secret little ticks and snaps into something which looked like a giant corsage, and began to fold the cardboard into a box exactly the right size for the lampshade. "I know you'll be a fine custodian of the item you have purchased. That's why I sold it to you."
"Really? I thought, Mr. Keaton, and the trick.
No, 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 Mr. Gaunt said, half laughing and half exasperated. Anyone will play a trick. People love to play tricks. But to place objects with people who love them and need them, that is a different kettle of fish altogether. Sometimes, Natisha, I think that what I really sell is happiness. What do you think?
Well, Nettie said earnestly, I know you've made me happy, Mr. Gaunt, very happy.
He exposed his crooked, jostling teeth in a wide smile.
Good. That's good.
Mr. Gaunt pushed the tissue paper corsage into the box, cradled the lampshade in its ticking whiteness, closed the box, and taped it shut with a flourish.
And here we are. Another satisfied customer has found her needful thing.
He held the box out to her. Nettie took it, and as her fingers touched his, she felt a shiver of revulsion, even though she had gripped them with great strength, even ardor, a few moments ago. But that interlude had already begun to seem hazy and unreal. He put the Tupperware cake container on top of the white box. She saw something inside the former.
What's that?
A note for your employer, Gaunt said. Alarm rose to Nettie's face at once.
Not about me.
Good heavens, no, Gaunt said, laughing, and Nettie relaxed at once. When he was laughing, Mr. Gaunt was impossible to resist or distrust. Take care of your lampshade, Natisha, and do come again.
I will,
Nettie said, and this could have been an answer to both admonitions, but she felt in her heart, that secret repository where needs and fears elbowed each other continuously, like uncomfortable passengers in a crowded subway car, that while she might come here again, the lampshade was the only thing she would ever buy in Needful Things. Yet, what of that? It was a beautiful thing, the sort of thing she had always wanted, the only thing she needed to complete her modest collection. She considered telling Mr. Gaunt that her husband might still be alive if he had not smashed a carnival glass lampshade much like this one 14 years ago, that it had been the last straw, the one which finally drove her over the edge. He had broken many of her bones during their years together, and she had let him live. Finally, he had broken something she really needed, and she had taken his life. She decided she did not have to tell Mr. Gaunt this. He looked like the sort of man who might already know.
Polly! Polly! She's coming out!
Polly left the dressmaker's dummy, where she had been slowly and carefully pinning up a hem, and hurried to the window. She and Rosalie stood side by side, watching as Nettie left Needful Things in a state which could only be described as heavily laden. Her purse was under one arm, her umbrella was under the other, and in her hands she held Polly's Tupperware cake container balanced atop a square white box.
Maybe I better go help her, Rosalie said.
No. Polly put out a hand and restrained her gently. Better not. I think she'd only be embarrassed and fluttery. They watched Nettie walk up the street. She no longer scuttled, as if before the jaws of a storm. Now she seemed almost to drift.
No, Polly thought. No, that isn't quite right. It's more like floating.
Her mind suddenly made one of those odd connections which were almost like cross-references, and she burst out laughing. Rosalie looked at her, eyebrows raised.
Cher?
It's the look on her face, Polly said,
watching Nettie cross Linden Street in slow, dreamy steps.
What do you mean?
She looks like a woman who just got laid and had about 3 orgasms.
Rosalie turned pink, looked at Nettie once more, and then screamed with laughter. Polly joined in. The two of them held each other and rocked back and forth, laughing wildly.
Gee, Alan Pangborn said from the front of the store. Ladies laughing at not quite 11:15 in the morning. It's too early for champagne, so what is it?
4,
Rosalie said, giggling madly. Tears were streaming down her cheeks.
It looked more like 4 to me.
Then they were off again, rocking back and forth in each other's arms, howling with laughter, while Alan stood watching them with his hands in the pockets of his uniform pants, smiling quizzically. Norris Ridgwick arrived at the sheriff's office in his street clothes about 10 minutes before the noon whistle blew at the mill. He had the mid-shift from 12 until 9 p.m. right through the weekend, and that was just the way he liked it. Let somebody else clean up the messes on the highways and byways of Castle County after the bars closed at 1 o'clock. He could do it, had done it on many occasions, but he almost always puked his guts. He sometimes puked his guts even if the victims were up, walking around, and yelling that they didn't have to take any fucking breathalyzer test. They knew their constitutional rights. Norris just had that kind of a stomach. Sheila Brigham liked to tease him by saying he was like Deputy Andy on that TV show, Twin Peaks, but Norris knew he wasn't. Deputy Andy cried when he saw dead people. Norris didn't cry, but he was apt to puke on them, the way he'd almost puked on Homer Gamage that time when he found Homer sprawled in a ditch out by Homeland Cemetery, beaten to death with his own artificial arm. Norris glanced at the roster, saw both Andy Clutterbuck and John LaPointe were out on patrol, then at the day watch board. Nothing there for him, which was also just the way he liked it. To make his day complete, this end of it at least, his second uniform had come back from the cleaners, on the day promised for once. That would save him a trip home to change. A note pinned to the dry cleaning bag read, "Hey Barney, you owe me $5.25. Do not stiff me, or you will be a sadder and wiser man when the sun goes down." It was signed, Clut. Norris's good mood was unbroken even by the note's salutation. Sheila Brigham was the only person in the Castle Rock Sheriff's Office who thought of Norris as a Twin Peaks kind of guy. Norris had an idea she was the only person in the department, besides himself that was, who even watched the show. The other deputies, John LaPointe, Seat Thomas, Andy Clutterbuck, called him Barney, after the Don Knotts character on the old Andy Griffith show. This sometimes irritated him, but not today. 4 days of mid-shift, then 3 days off. A whole week of silk laid out before him. Life could sometimes be grand. He pulled a 5 and a 1 from his wallet and laid them on Clut's desk. "Hey, Clut, live a little," he jotted on the back of a report form, signed his name with a flourish, and left it by the money. Then he stripped the dry cleaning bag off the uniform and took it into the men's room. He whistled as he changed clothes, then waggled his eyebrows approvingly as he stared at his reflection in the mirror. He was squared away, by God. 100% squared away. The evildoers of Castle Rock had damned well better be on the lookout today, or... He caught movement behind him in the mirror, but before he could do more than begin to turn his head, he had been grabbed, spun around, and slammed into the tiles beside the urinals. His head bonked the wall, his cap fell off, and then he was looking into the round, flushed face of Danforth Keaton. "What in the hell do you think you're doing, Ridgwick?" he asked. Norris had forgotten all about the ticket he had slipped under the windshield wiper of Keaton's Cadillac the night before. Now it all came back to him. "Let go of me," he said. He tried for a tone of indignation, but his voice came out in a worried squeak. He felt his cheeks growing hot. Whenever he was angry or scared, and right now he was both, he blushed like a girl. Keaton, who overtopped Norris by 5 inches and outweighed him by 100 pounds, gave the deputy a harsh little shake and then didn't let go. He pulled the ticket out of his pocket and brandished it under Norris's nose. "Is this your name on this goddamn thing, or isn't it?" he demanded, as though Norris had already denied it. Norris Ridgwick knew perfectly well that it was his signature, rubber-stamped, but perfectly recognizable, and that the ticket had been pulled from his citation book. "You were parked in the crip space," he said, stepping away from the wall and rubbing the back of his head. Damned if he didn't think there was going to be a knot there. As his initial surprise, and Buster had jumped the living Jesus out of him, he couldn't deny that, abated, his anger grew. "The what?" "The handicap space," Norris shouted. "And furthermore, it was Alan himself who told me to write that ticket," he was about to continue, and then didn't. "Why give this fat pig the satisfaction of passing the buck? You've been told about it before, Danforth, and you know it." "What did you call me?" Danforth Keaton asked ominously. Red splotches the size of cabbage roses had grown on his cheeks and jowls.
"That's a valid ticket," Norris said, ignoring this last, "and as far as I'm concerned, you better pay it. Why, you're lucky I don't cite you for assaulting a police officer as well."
Danforth laughed. The sound banged flatly off the walls.
"I don't see any police officer," he said. "I see a narrow piece of shit packaged to look like beef jerky."
Norris bent over and picked up his hat. His guts were a roil of fear. Danforth Keaton was a bad enemy for a man to have. And his anger had deepened into fury. His hands trembled. He took a moment, nonetheless, to set his hat squarely on his head.
"You can take this up with Allen if you want. I'm taking it up with you. But I'm done talking about it. Make sure you pay that within 30 days, Danforth, or we'll have to come and get you."
Norris drew himself up to his full 5'6" and added, "We know where to find you." He started out. Keaton, his face now looking like sunset in a nuclear blast area, stepped forward to block his escape route. Norris stopped and leveled a finger at him.
"If you touch me, I'll throw you in a cell, Buster. I mean it."
"Okay, that's it," Keaton said in a queer, toneless voice. "That is it. You're fired. Take off that uniform and start looking for another job."
"No,"
a voice said from behind him. And they both looked around. Alan Pangborn was standing in the men's room doorway. Keaton rolled his hands into fat, white fists.
"You keep out of this."
Alan walked in, letting the door swoosh slowly shut behind him.
"No," he said. "I was the one that told Norris to write that ticket. I also told him I was going to forgive it before the appropriations meeting. It's a $5 ticket, Dan. What the hell got into you?"
Alan's voice was puzzled. He felt puzzled. Buster had never been a sweet-natured man, not even at the best of times. But an outburst like this was overboard even for him. Since the end of the summer, the man had seemed ragged and always on edge. Alan had often heard the distant bellow of his voice when the selectmen were in committee meetings, and his eyes had taken on a look which was almost haunted. He wondered briefly if Keaton might be sick and decided that was a consideration for some later time. Right now, he had a moderately ugly situation on his hands.
"Nothing got into me," Keaton said sulkily and smoothed back his hair.
Norris took some satisfaction in noticing that Keaton's hands were also trembling.
"I'm just good and goddamn tired of self-important pricks like this man here. I try to do a lot for this town. Hell, I accomplish a lot for this town. And I'm sick of the constant persecution."
He paused a moment, his fat throat working, and then burst out,
"He called me Buster. You know how I feel about that."
"He'll apologize," Alan said calmly. "Won't you, Norris?"
"I don't know that I will,"
Norris said. His voice was trembly and his gut was rolling, but he was still angry.
"I know he doesn't like it, but the truth is he surprised it out of me. I was just standing here, looking in the mirror to make sure my tie was straight, when he grabbed me and threw me against the wall. I smacked my head a pretty good one. Geez, Alan, I don't even know what I said."
Alan's eyes shifted back to Keaton. "Is that true?" Keaton dropped his own eyes.
"I was mad," he said, and Alan supposed it was as close as a man like him could get to a spontaneous and undirected apology.
He glanced back at Norris to see if the deputy understood this. It looked as if maybe Norris did. That was good. It was a long step toward defusing this nasty little stink bomb. Alan relaxed a little.
"Can we consider this incident closed?" he asked both men. "Just kind of chalk it up to experience and go on from there?"
"All right by me," Norris said after a moment. Alan was touched. Norris was scrawny. He had a habit of leaving half-full cans of Jolt and Knee-High in the cruisers he used, and his reports were horrors, but he had yards of heart. He was backing down, but not because